Well, deep center. Rajay Davis makes the catch on the warning track.
Dropped it.
Or did he?
I think he dropped it.
I got an out call with Field and Colbert. He's calling him out. This is going to be a double play. And the game is over.
He caught that ball.
How do you like me now?
There's Lindor.
Liftoff. Way back and gone to Souvenir City. Francisco Lindor, his ninth home run on the year. And a pair of solo shots here in the first.
Wow.
Uh-oh. Francisco Lindor drives one deep and way out of here. His second home run of the afternoon.
There's a fly ball to left off the bat of Uribe. Well back down the line and gone.
Nice.
First pitch of the fifth inning, Juan Uribe. There's a fly ball to right off the bat of Naquin. Way back in right and gone.
Wow.
On a 1-0, Tyler Naquin hits his sixth home run. Back-to-back home runs for the Indians. Justin had a long fourth inning, and the fifth inning started with back-to-back home runs in the first three pitches. Fly ball to left off the bat of Napoli, and goodbye.
Nice.
Line drive that just sizzled out of here.
Whoa.
Here goes the runner, swinging a fly ball right field. This one's deep off the bat of Chisenhall, and over the glove of a leaping Mike Avilas. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. It is the fourth home run of the inning for the Cleveland Indians against Justin Verlander.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
You know, I got to tell you, as we get started on this Monday afternoon edition of the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, sometimes it's great to be wrong. I mean, really, it's okay. I've never been too proud to admit when I am wrong. For example, I was wrong that Jim Harbaugh wasn't going to come leave the NFL to come back to Michigan. I thought he'd stay there. Had to admit it, own it. And this one is much, much less significant than that because it's only a simple weekend series in the middle of a long, long baseball season. But Friday, we did a little bit of a three-man roundtable, four-man counting Jim Cushman, who chimed in from time to time. But we had a little bit of a baseball roundtable discussion as the Indians were set to lift off a weekend series at Comerica against the Tigers. And the Indians came in red hot, having won six in a row going into the weekend. The Tigers came in very hot as well, having swept a four-game series from the Mariners. Two good teams playing really good baseball at a really interesting time. Just, about 2 weeks from the All-Star break. And I said, as we talked to Zach Meisel of Cleveland, well, from Cleveland, Cleveland.com, and Anthony Fenech of the Detroit Free Press with our little Indians-Tigers roundtable discussion, I said to both guys, I said, I'm under no illusions. There's no way that the Tigers, who have already lost six straight to the Indians this season, are going to get swept again. And I said, I have no belief that the Indians are going to sweep the Tigers again. And guess what else? I don't think the Tigers are going to sweep the Indians. It's probably only going to be a one-game shift in the standings here because it's going to be 2-1 one way or the other. The Indians are going to win 2 out of 3 and extend their lead over the Tigers by a game, or the Tigers are going to win 2 out of 3 and cut the four-game deficit by a game. That's just the way it's probably going to be. And Jim, I think Meisel said the same thing.
Right.
I think Fenech said the same thing.
I pretty much said the same thing.
You
I didn't sweep was going to happen either way.
Ain't no sweep going to happen here. You know, nobody's going 9-0 against the other guys in this situation. It's not like we're talking about the 27 Yankees against, some 100-loss team. There's no way that, somebody's going 9-0 against the other guys in this particular season series. And then Friday happened. And wow, what an unbelievable win. And by the way, great little montage of clips from the games, Jim Cushman. Then Saturday happened, another dominating pitching performance from Carlos Carrasco. And then yesterday, for the sweep? Really? Josh Tomlin and Justin Verlander? This isn't happening, is it? Bang! Four home runs in a single inning? Another sweep? 9-0? Nine straight for the Indians in this, as far as their current winning streak. 9-0 against the Tigers this year. Suddenly there are seven games of separation between the Indians and the Tigers. Suddenly the Indians are starting to do what I said nobody really is going to do in the American League Central. Neither the Indians, nor the Royals, nor the Tigers are going to pull, and I even included the White Sox in that conversation, are going to pull away from the pack and run away and hide. I don't think anybody's going to really fall off the face of the map either. It's going to be pretty nip and tuck for those three or four teams pretty much all season and all summer long. And yet here we sit on June 27, the Indians having won nine in a row, having won and dominating. As Jim, you pointed out many, many times during our conversation, our little roundtable, dominating within the division and continuing to do so. Now they have pulled away. What in the world is that? Now they have indeed pulled away to the tune of a 5-game lead over the Royals and a 7-game lead over the Tigers and the White Sox.
And that's the 500 mark, by the way.
Say again?
The Tigers and White Sox, that's the 500 mark, by the way.
Back at the 500 mark, yeah. The Tigers, of course, had climbed over it with their streak and now right back at it. But the Indians have the third largest lead of any division in baseball. Only the Cubs, who have, by the way, fallen back down to earth a little bit, and they still lead their division by 9 games because of that ridiculous start that they had. And then the Giants
they're still playing 649 ball, too.
Exactly. Still just killing it, and still the best record in baseball, but only by percentage points over the Rangers, who are sitting at – they're playing 645 ball at 49-27. But anyway, as far as division leads go – oh, I take that back. I forgot about the Rangers. So it's the fourth. So they're the fourth biggest lead in the division. So out of six. So it's not as impressive as it sounded. But it's impressive to me because, like I said, I really expect this division, whether the Royals eventually surge to the top, I expect it to be one or two or three. Whether it's the Tigers or the Indians or the White Sox, I expect it to be one or two or three games at the most separating them going into the stages where divisions are won or lost going into September. And right now, again, we're 2 weeks from the All-Star break, but the pitching that the Cleveland Indians are getting, not once in a while, but night after night, not from the top of the rotation, but then they're just getting some, you know, lucky quality starts from the four and five spots. Every pitcher in the Indian starting rotation right now, dare I say Jim Cushlin, is pitching like a front of the rotation pitcher. I don't want to use the words staff ace. That might be pushing it a little bit, not to mention the fact that ace can be, you know, interpreted by many different people to be many different things.
Sure.
You know, you don't have to be, a Verlander, Justin Verlander circa 20, what was it, 11 or 12 that he won the MVP? 11, I think. Anyway, you don't have to be that to be the staff ace, just the best pitcher on that staff. But if the staff stinks, then you don't get the title of ace. So it's just kind of, you know, it's subjective, and you get to play with that a little bit. But I don't care if it's Kluber, Salazar, Carrasco, Tomlin, or Trevor Bauer, who wasn't supposed to be in the rotation, even though I said going into game one of the season, Jim, that he should have been in the rotation. And it took Cody Anderson falling apart, and he was not ready for prime time, obviously.
Let's remember, yes, last year when he had that outstanding year, which got him in the rotation, He basically came straight from Double A. Yep. In a way, this was kind of expected.
And he started to, in spring training, started to show cracks that little magical run he had last year was not something he's ready to continue to, you know, to go on. He didn't pitch well enough in spring training during a spot in the rotation at all. No doubt about it. Trevor Bauer outpitched him and did not get that spot. So it took his falling flat on his face and the injury to Carlos Carrasco, who was on the DL for 4 or 5 weeks, for Bauer to get into the rotation. And all he has done is pitch, quite frankly, like an ace. Like a first guy in any baseball rotation. That's the that's just the fact of the matter. All five of these guys are having one outing after the other that just, hey, I'm going to one-up you, and I'm going to one-up you, and it just builds and builds and builds. And guess what? Sooner or later, there's no doubt, the other shoe will drop. Somebody's going to have a bad outing, and that will put a little pressure on the next guy to stop that. And then if that one does, and it can go the other direction. It can. And it very likely will, maybe not with all five at one time.
That's how baseball over the course of 162 usually works.
Bingo. I mean, you just can't stay that good, that consistent all the time. And how will they respond once it starts to go south a little bit? But, Jim, pitching in baseball is pitching. And that's not profound, I know. But what I mean is this isn't accidental. The numbers being put up by this five-man rotation right now is not accidental. What the Tigers ran into over the weekend wasn't a hot team with some starters who are in a hot streak right now. They've been in this hot streak, with the exception of Anderson and some of the other guys who've moved down, since April 1. They really have been. This pitching staff is better than what it was billed, and it was billed to be one of the best in the American League. I mean, Danny Salazar is not the best pitcher in this rotation, and yet he's pitching like he could start the All-Star game next month. You realize that. His numbers are that good, and he's not the best of these pitchers. I mean, Kluber is still the best, but his numbers aren't the best because of, you know, a few down outings, you know, a couple of big run innings that kind of skewed a couple of starts and his overall numbers. But he's probably still the most consistent, and dominant starter they have. But the rotation is exceeding its billing. None of their starters has an ERA. Now I want you to listen to some of these stats. You know, ERA, they have the sixth best ERA in baseball. We talked about this. I'm going to get to the specifics of the games against the Tigers in a minute, but they had going into the weekend the sixth best ERA in baseball, and I don't know how much that changed over the weekend. I got to look at the current updated team pitching stats as far as ERA goes. And that sixth best, by the way, is their ranking is dragged down to six rather than being higher, is what I'm trying to say. Because of Cody Anderson and his run of poor starts. He had some very bad starts, as we know, and that's why he's not, you know, with the big league club right now. Taking even those starts into consideration, they still have the sixth best. None of the Indians' current starters has an ERA plus lower than 125. And while some of that speaks to the defense of the team, a lot of it has to do with just the arms. Danny Salazar's wildness, this is quoting from ESPN today, or excuse me, not ESPN, CBS today, with a look at this red-hot Indians team and why they could very well be better than what they are now. This is why the Indians are one of the baseball's top contenders and how they might even be better. But Salazar's wildness hasn't prevented him from making a case to start the All-Star game next month. Corey Kluber and Carlos Carrasco are performing like what they are, safe bets that they appeared to be front end of the rotation stars. Trevor Bauer has returned from his bullpen exile in a way reminiscent of Carrasco a few years back. And then there's Tomlin, the oddball command and control artist sprinkled among a former Cy Young Award winner and bunch of stuff-rich power arms throwing everybody off kilter. You know, you get the power of Carrasco, power arm of Kluber, power arm of Salazar, and, yeah, even the power arm of Bauer, and then here comes Tomlin with his little dink and dunk and just putting it over here. He can just kind of command the ball wherever he wants. Can't get it up hot much higher than 90, 91. And yet he's what, 9-1 after beating the Tigers yesterday. The key to Tomlin's success, limiting base runners ahead of the home runs he inevitably allows, and he did. And so far he's on the right side of that slope. His stats tell the story perfectly. The highest hit rate, the highest home run rate, the lowest walk rate, and lowest strikeout rate in the rotation, and yet he has more wins than anybody else. So just, it's an unbelievable thing to watch take place. And as I inevitably, looking with a cynical eye as I do at various things because of history, because I have seen hopes get dashed so easily in other circumstances, particularly when it comes to teams that I root for from my home city, that sort of thing, I get cynical. So while I cynically just wait for the other shoe to drop and for all of this to fall apart, I have to then remind myself, you know, this isn't accidental. This isn't a hot run. This isn't a bunch of guys just caught fire at the same time. It's lightning in a bottle, and as soon as it's open, it's gone. These arms have been building to become this for the last several years, especially Kluber, Carrasco, and Salazar. Bauer, to an extent, but not like the others. The others were considered to be sure thing stars if they can stay healthy and get consistent. Bauer was you know what? He might have it. He might be the goods. He might be. There was a reason he was such a high pick. There's a reason why he was, his stuff was considered among the best of any prospect 5 years ago. But it's, can he get his mind to be in sync with that arm? Can he get his mind to be in sync with his manager and with his pitching coach and with the training regimen, et cetera, et cetera? Can he do all of that? He could be a star. He could be a bust. And he's had, you know, over the last two seasons, he's had stretches where he was both. stretches of stardom very clearly laid out, where you can see it all, you know, come to fruition before you. And he's had stretches of, man, this dude just can't figure it out. He's out of his mind. He's upset. He's angry. He's wild again. He's trying to use too many pitches. He's not in sync with his pitching coach, et cetera. And he's looked like, man, this isn't going to work. But right now he has put it all together. He's the one where you might say he could still kind of lose it again. But the other four, including Tomlin, again, who doesn't rely on power, just relies on guile and pitching knowledge, I don't think it goes away, barring injury. I don't think it goes away. And it's interesting for one other reason. We'll go to the phones in a second as we talk more about this series that the Indians just took from the Tigers. 9-0 now against Detroit. It's really interesting. One headline story that I read with interest today was the one that I just quoted from for you from CBS, which is the Indians, why the Indians are one of top MLB's top contenders right now and how they might get even better. And the other one going the other direction, saying, Indians know, despite 9-game winning streak, they can't get complacent. They're not going to get excited about this. Jim Cushman's going to get excited about this. Bob France is going to get excited about this. Fans who don't, I'm trying to figure out a way to be gentle with the attendance figures. The fans are going to get excited about it without spending any money doing so. But the Indians themselves are going to stay very, very low key and very, very, very Terry Francona-ish, if you will. Because Terry Francona, the manager of the Indians, is a guy who never, ever lets one of these stretches pump him up into believing something that can't be believed in a 162-game schedule, that they're that good. And he never lets one of those bad stretches make him believe that his team is that bad. He just knows that there are cycles to a season, and if he keeps everybody at an even keel, personality level or emotional level, if you want to say, or mindset, then that will be the best chance of maximizing this team's strengths.
And in terms of maximizing it, I mean, you point out a lot of things regarding the pitching, and it's all obviously true as we know right now with this Indian staff, but in order to get on, you know, not just streaks like this, but overall good enough play to spot yourself 13 games over 500 atop a division by 5 games. As we've been saying, you need more, and this series kind of encapsulates some of that too. You need hitting in various spots. It was a triples fest on Friday. Then Lindor has a couple home runs, which you heard in the montage Saturday. They get 4 in one inning off of Verlander yesterday. And then usually
something that's only happened to Verlander, by the way, one other time in his career also. Against the Indians,
yeah.
Strangely enough, that was what, 07?
07, which yeah. At that point would have been his second year in the league, I think, or third tops. I can't remember if his rookie year was 05 or 06.
Right.
So you need that stuff, too, in addition to your pitching. You need some good hitting, and overall, despite everything, you know, meaning things like Brantley hasn't been there and so on and so forth, yeah, they're getting some of that production right now. And then, quite frankly, you need a little bit of luck. See that final play to end Friday night's game. I'd never seen that before.
The juggling catch
and everybody in the stadium, or at least everybody, you know, running down or at least running for the Tigers, thought was dropped. It wasn't.
I was going
to
say.
So you throw it back for the double play to end the game. I've seen weird plays for double plays like that, usually not to end the game. And that fits the luck category. Sometimes you also need a little bit of luck here and there.
Well, I guess. But you know what? It was a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah.
You know, it was a lot of ground to cover to get over and make that first bobble and then, you know, catch it on the second try. So it's luck, yeah, but it's also great play. It's a great play, too. So I don't know if I want to credit that all to luck. But to your point, you're right. You can't win divisions just solely being we are much better than everybody else most of the time. Most of the time, a team is going to win a division absolutely needing needing certain components of talent, getting hot at the right time, being clutch, even if it isn't a strong point of the team, being clutch when they need that particular aspect, whether it be a start, a close, an at-bat, or whatever it is. And, yes, you do need the component of luck because there are times that that is the case. I forgot who was on second. It was already across the plate. The throwback in the second, I mean, he could have jogged in there and tapped it himself. There was no way for both runners to go all the way back around. And it was a weird way to end a game. There's no doubt about it. But I will say this once again, though, keeping everything in perspective, everything is temporary. Everything is temporary. And what I mean by that is this. the Detroit Tigers flat out for a three-year period, really a four-year period almost, owned the Cleveland Indians to the point, I think it was from 20, oh, now I lost my page again here. I wanted to give the exact quote about what the Indians were against the Tigers for this three-year stretch. I think it was 19 and 37 from 2013, 14, and 15. Those three combined years is, I think, what it was. 19 and 37. Maybe it's 2012. Maybe it's a four-year period. I'm not doing the math very clearly here. But the bottom line being that the Tigers absolutely had owned the Indians. And for the Indians to be 9-0 against this team right now has to feel amazing, tremendously good. But guess what? You cannot just say we are that much better than those guys, because everything like that is temporary. It's going to come to an end. Oh, here it is. It was 2013 to 2016. 2013 up to this year, so I guess that should read through 2015. The Indians were 19-37, and obviously, conversely, the Tigers 37-19 against the Cleveland Indians. And this year, the Indians have won 9 straight against the Tigers. It's just hard to wrap your brain around. And it's also hard, to be quite honest with you, to think that it's going to be that simple. The Tigers aren't going away that easily. And not that they're a great team, and you're just waiting for them to kick in and run away with this, but they are too good, not great, but too good, to just kind of fold and fall by the wayside the way they did a year ago, I believe. And do not think for a second, if you're an Indians fan, that the Royals are done with this either. The defending champions are 5 back. They have not even hit their stride. They are a very, very good second half team, as we know, over the last couple of years. So this is not something that the Indians can just coast on, not even a little bit. From the Tiger standpoint, though, I will say this. There is a little bit of angst up in the D. There is some angst. I was reading a couple of different columnists up in the Free Press and the Detroit News and others, as I always try to get as many different perspectives on things as I can. But there is some angst up there in the D, as quite honestly, a lot of the media up that have been covering the Tigers are kind of starting to see the hot spell that they had as being the mirage. That was the outlier, not who they really are. That was the the outlier, that the real Tigers are just flat out mediocre. They're a mediocre team that isn't going to be good and that isn't going to be horrible, but this is just what they are. And as the Indians start to pull away a little bit now, a 7-game gap here on June 27th, is it time for them to start thinking about possibly, maybe, moving some assets, becoming sellers at the deadline, which of course is still, 4.5 weeks away. That maybe this is the team's the 3-game sweep, this most recent 3-game sweep, is the team's wake up call that says, okay, it's not going to be there. We really do need to start thinking about improving this team for the long haul. So what does it mean? We will see. We are going to talk with Dennis Maniloff here in a few. He's going to give us his thoughts on the sweep up at Comerica that none of us saw coming. I really thought this would be a 2-1 series, one way or the other. But the sweep gives the Indians. By the way, Jim, and this is how baseball is.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope I'm wrong on this one, too. I started the show by saying, sometimes it's good to be wrong. You're glad when you get one wrong, and I didn't see a sweep happening here. So I hope I'm wrong on this one, too. But I'm going to say it anyway. This is one of those trap series as the Indians go to Atlanta to play the horrid, and I do mean horrid, Atlanta Braves, one of the worst teams in baseball at 26-49.
Only team worse is Minnesota.
There you go.
Who has a good record against the Indians this year?
That's what I'm talking about. Right. Thank you. That's exactly what I'm talking about. They're 9 in a row, and you think, now they're going to go down there and play the Braves. They're going to be able to stretch this thing to 12 in a row. And then watch them go down there and lose 2 out of 3 to that horrible team. I hope I'm wrong, obviously, like I said, but it's just one of those things that the way baseball is. Sometimes.
Plus, I'll mention this again here in a bit. I believe I mentioned it in my sports center, but what a strange dynamic. I heard that this is only the second interleague series the Indians have ever played in Atlanta. So that makes them apparently 0-6 all time in baseball games played in Atlanta.
Stop.
Just funky.
I don't want to hear that. That is,
and that's including playoffs, i.e. the 95 World
Series. I know what you meant. That's why I said stop, because I don't want to be thinking about that. I really do not want to be thinking about that at all. By the way, if you're wondering, and again, we'll talk to Maniloff about this, about whether it's in the cards for them to continue their streak. I, I, uh, I got to say, with the exception of what I just pointed out, this is just how baseball is. You know, a red-hot team plays a horrible team, and the horrible team, you know, roughs them up a little bit for some strange reason, right?
Right.
Having said that, looking at the pitching matchups, especially Trevor Bauer going tonight, 5-2 with a 3.20 ERA, Kluber coming, I'm having a hard time. I really am a hard time seeing baseball happening in this situation. Just what I mean by that is just baseball. The bad team beats the good team. At a time when the good team is red hot. All right, we'll talk to Maniloff about all of this and more. We have a lot of NBA news to talk about today. Talking about free agency, obviously, the Kevin Durant sweepstakes, also the Olympics, and the combination of the NBA and the Olympics. A lot of NBA guys not going to represent Team USA in Rio, and a lot of other Olympic athletes wishing they didn't have to go to represent their country in Rio for a lot of very, very disgusting reasons. And I'll explain what that means as we continue. So we got baseball, we got basketball, we got Olympics to talk about. And although I am no fan at all of international soccer or European soccer or soccer of any kind, the fact that one of the game's biggest stars is quitting because he can't win when it matters most is hysterical to me. Absolutely so very soccer of Lionel or Lionel or whatever his name Messi is. Again, it's not my game. It's not my sport. I don't deny it. I'll wear that proudly. I find it hilarious that the guy who was supposed to be the Gretzky of soccer quit because he can't win when it matters most. We'll get into that a little bit, too, coming up on the Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Well armed and ready for battle were the Cleveland Indians, and I say that with a pun intended. The arms of the Cleveland Indians starting rotation just absolutely decimating the Detroit Tigers lineup for the better part of three straight games, and quite honestly, four, of course, all nine meetings that they have had this season. From 2013 to this season, the Tigers had owned the Cleveland Indians 37-19. 37-19 leading up to this particular season, but this year it has been the exact opposite. The Indians 9-0 against Detroit, now having won nine straight games overall on this winning streak, heading into a last place Atlanta tonight. And with a five-game cushion over the Royals, seven games over the Tigers and the White Sox in the American League Central, the Indians are threatening to actually become, I don't know, maybe contenders. And I know it's June 24th, not August 24th, let alone September 24th, but maybe contenders to be a real, you know, a player in the American League playoffs. And I don't mean just qualify. I mean a force. I mean a straight-up force. The story I read earlier this hour from CBS talking about how and why the Indians are right now one of MLB's biggest and best contenders, but most importantly, how they can get even better very, very soon. That is what we're talking about here. And joining us now to talk about that is our good friend Dennis Maniloff from Cleveland and the Northeast Ohio Media Group, Cleveland Plain Dealer. He is also the author of From A to Z, Andrew's Two Zastadola Collection of Dennis Maniloff's Best Sports Interviews and Favorite Sports Interviews. D-Man, how are you, bud?
Hey, thanks for having me, Bob.
It's always good to have you. I mean, we'll talk about the specifics of the series in a moment because I know that's what most of our audience is interested in. They want to know why their Tigers collapsed, or Indians fans want to know how exactly they got so dominant right now. But just from that context, I have been saying for a long time now this season that I do not expect anybody from the Royals, Tigers, Indians, White Sox quadrant, if you will, to pull away here. It's going to be nip and tuck most of the summer until things are sorted out in September. But the Indians, even though it's only June 24th, are making at least a little bit of a statement that perhaps somebody might pull away here, and it might be them.
Yeah, that's very possible, Bob. I obviously didn't see this. I had them at 82-80 before the season started, so they're far exceeding my expectations. You know, and it starts, no secret, it starts with their starting pitching. You have Kluber that's more resembling the 2014 Cy Young Kluber than the 2015 version. You have Salazar pitching well. You have Carrasco just coming off of a dominant performance in Detroit. He's starting to get his stride after that injury, that hamstring injury. And then Trevor Bauer has really turned it around under the guidance of Chris Giménez, the catcher, and then the fifth guy, Josh Tomlin, is not pitching like a fifth guy. So when you have all five of those guys healthy and pitching well, you feel like you have a chance to win every night, and that's the way the Indians feel right now.
Yeah, and there's you know, there's no doubt that this key is indeed the starting rotation. The starting rotation was identified as the key before the season began, and whether you picked the team to go 82-80 the way you did or to win, you know, 92 games and maybe to be a division champion, everybody said it was going to be because of the pitching. But Dennis, the pitchers have outperformed even the greatest of expectations, and there were expectations that they might have the best rotation in the American League, and they might be better than that, just from, you know, not compared to the other teams, but measured against their own success of the past and projections for this year. I think they might be as a five-some. This particular group, obviously Cody Anderson started out as part of it, is not part of it any longer, but this particular five-some is outperforming even what the highest of expectations had.
Yeah, I think it comes from the exceeding expectations comes primarily from Bauer and Tomlin, because the expectations were already high for Kluber. I mean, he's got a Cy Young, and he was, you know, he's viewed as the ace, as he should be, or the number one. I know some people don't like to use the term ace, but
we had that discussion. We had that discussion about 20 minutes ago, because, you know, that's a subjective term, ace. Whether you're the number one starter on a staff, it doesn't necessarily make you an ace unless that staff is really, really good.
But he's the top of their heap, and so the expectations are high for Kluber, they're high for Carrasco, and they're high for Salazar. But Bauer has, you know, obviously it couldn't have been that high for Bauer heading into the year because he was in the bullpen. And Tomlin has always been kind of a gritty, gutty, you know, fill-in type. But he has really emerged and taken that other spot in the rotation. Again, I say other spot as opposed to fifth spot because he's not pitching like it. And these guys, you know, I don't think they necessarily want to be slotted one through five. They all feel like they're capable of winning, and I think if you ask each one of them, you know, Kluber doesn't need to have a one next to his name. Carrasco doesn't need to have a two next to his name. You know, they all view each other fairly equally, but because of what Tomlin and Bauer have done, that has really solidified the rotation to where, at this moment anyway, there really aren't any holes.
I had a conversation with your colleague, Zach Meisel, on Friday, along with Anthony Fennec, who's a Tigers beat writer for the Detroit Free Press. We had a little mini roundtable thing going on, and we were talking about the fact that numbers and labels don't really matter to these guys. In fact, I was talking about what the Tigers are fortunate they don't have to face Corey Kluber, and then I looked at who they are facing, though, and I said, wait a minute, what does it matter? With this particular rotation, the way they have all been pitching, it doesn't matter if you get 1, 2, and 3 in what is the, you know, the actual listed order of the rotation, or if you get the 2, 3, and 4, or you get the 3, 4, and 5 guys. It doesn't matter. Between, you know, from Kluber to Tomlin, there is no weak spot in that rotation. Not one guy there that isn't capable of shutting you down, if not shutting you out, for 8 innings or more into a complete game. And that's what the Tigers had to contend with. And quite honestly, that's what they weren't able to contend with, because it's true. It doesn't matter what number of starter you face, you're facing one of the best pitchers in the American League, at least it seems.
Yeah, I mean, it's not often, Bob, that you can get all five of your guys clicking at once, but that is the case at this moment. You don't know how long it's going to last. You know, pitchers have slumps just like hitters do. But at this moment, in this, obviously, the 9-game winning streak, and even before that a little bit, these five guys have been pitching well together as a unit, almost five guys on a string, and that makes it incredibly, you know, difficult to beat if you're the opposition. And the other good news about the Cleveland staff is, you know, they're not doing it with smoke and mirrors. I mean, you're talking about four guys in Kluber, Carrasco, Salazar, Bauer, who are power arms. I mean, no one would confuse them with finesse. I mean, these guys throw mid to high 90s with the heater. They've got the hard breaking stuff. They got the hard change up. You know, they can change. They can switch speeds and arm angles on their curveballs and their sliders. So that's a power four. And then Tomlin, you know, he's the finesse guy of the group, but he's such a smart pitcher. And you know, even though his fastball is 89-90, He knows how to move it around the zone. He's got pinpoint control. Right now he has more victories than walks. He has 9 wins and 8 walks this season. So, you know, he's got incredible control. He's very high baseball IQ, so he knows how to pitch to guys, how to set them up. He cuts the ball really well. He spins it really well. So they have a staff where you don't have to look at it. You don't look at it and say, oh, well, you know what, this bubble's going to burst because, you know, all they're doing is tricking people. That's not how it is with this group.
Dennis Manilow is our guest from Cleveland. He is with the Cleveland Plain Dealer covering the Indians. We're talking about the Tigers and Indians series over the weekend. There was no way I anticipated another sweep. I told Meisel and Fenix, somebody's going to win 2 and somebody's going to win 1. Neither team is getting swept here. Obviously, I was wrong. And it wasn't just the arms, though. We got to talk about some timely hitting. Not just timely hitting, but, you know, I mean, see, when you get in the habit, As a fan of the Indians, Dennis, of talking about their strengths and weaknesses, you always talk about the arms, or at least recently anyway, about the arms, but the weaknesses, right-handed bats, power, et cetera. Do they have enough juice in the lineup to score runs that you need to if the pitching is off? But I think we have to stop saying that. At what point during this season do you think we stop saying, you're not going to get much out of the offense? Do you stop when you get 4 triples in a game? Does it stop when you get 4 home runs in an inning? Do you stop when... I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, they weren't supposed to be this good offensively, and yet here we sit. And they're beating up some pretty good teams. They're beating up some pretty good pitchers, and they're showing that, you know, you said they're not doing it with smoke and mirrors with the arms. Are they doing it with smoke and mirrors at the plate?
You know what? That's a great question, Bob. I don't know when you stop asking it, you know, but it does seem like, you know, where are they getting this from? How is this happening, especially when you consider Michael Brantley, one of the best players in the American League, if not baseball, one of the best hitters in the game, has played 11 games for the Cleveland Indians. And I thought, you know, if you were going to have any chance, if this team was going to have any chance to contend, it had to have a full season on Michael Brantley coming back from shoulder surgery in the offseason. That hasn't happened. He's only played 11. His status is very much in doubt for weeks to come. So who knows? But, I mean, a classic example of what you're talking about, Bob, was yesterday, all right, against Justin Verlander, who I believe is throwing the ball reasonably well, okay? I do. Just because he gave up a lot of runs yesterday doesn't mean he's a dog.
Well, he had a season ERA going into that game. He had a season ERA of 3.75, and while that might not be the MVP Cy Young Verlander type numbers that he used to put up, you get under 4 in the American League, you're doing your job pretty well.
Absolutely. Right. So Verlander is no tomato can, all right? He gives up 4 home runs in one inning, which was remarkable in itself. But think about the guys who took him deep. Juan Uribe, Mike Napoli, Naquin, then Napoli and Chisenhall. I believe that was the order.
Yes.
So, you know, it's like, okay, Napoli, I guess, I expect, but this is what the 2016 Indians offense has been about. You don't necessarily know where the production is coming from, but when you look at the box score at the end of the game, you know, it's there somehow, okay? 1 through 9, I mean, Chisenhall gives you 4 for 4 yesterday with a triple and a homer. Uribe, you know, can give you some pop. Jose Ramirez, who's, you know, Uribe's understudy, he's been a pleasant surprise. Napoli doing what he does, of course. Lindor being a star, there's no question. Kipnis being productive. But it's even more about the mainstays in the lineup. It's about the other pieces, parts, if you will, that are producing. And I say this, Bob, I don't recall, I'm sure there are examples, I just don't recall one at this moment, of a manager who has juggled his personnel as well as Terry Francona has through 74 games of the 2016 season. He has been able to mix and match in that lineup and get guys days off and get guys rest and figure out who needs to play against lefties and who needs to play against righties and where they need to be in the lineup. It has been a pleasure to watch Francona, maneuver his personnel to the extent that it's not only 44 and 30, but has been a productive, highly productive offense.
We're talking Indians, Tigers, weekend series, another sweep by the Indians, so the conversation is kind of centered around them. I want to read you a quick paragraph from Drew Sharp up in Detroit at the Free Press. We usually talk to his colleague Anthony Fennec on this program, who's on the beat for the Tigers, but talking about how embarrassing this weekend was for the Tigers against the Indians. And he pointed out this: the Indians are the best team in the division because they've got the best starting pitching. And it's a rotation forged mostly from various trading deadline sell-offs, moving overvalued veterans for young arms that required patience, persistence, and a fair amount of good luck. Sunday's winning starter, Josh Tomlin, was the only member of the rotation that the Indians drafted. They got I wonder how many people realize the things that I'm about to say that Drew Sharp recounted. They got Carlos Carrasco in the deal that sent Cliff Lee to the Phillies. We all remember the outrage over sending Cliff Lee, another Cy Young Award winner, away. Carlos Carrasco didn't pay immediate dividends in the next 2 or even 3 years, but look where he is now. That's me talking. Back to Drew Sharp quoting. They got Trevor Bauer in a deal that cost them Shin-Soo Choo, who was headed to free agency following that season anyway. Pitcher Jake Westbrook was the biggest piece in a 2010 trading deadline deal that landed the Indians Corey Kluber, who won the Cy Young Award in 2014. And Danny Salazar was an international free agent when the Indians signed him at 16. And that's the one where, you know, you might say a little bit of good luck was involved, a lot of prognostication. What do you see in a 16-year-old that you can predict how he will be as a 24-year-old? It's really hard to tell. But that's exactly right. So I bring that up only to give credit to a front office that has long been maligned for not getting, you know, young talent and making the right moves and trading guys that are popular with the fans that they don't necessarily want to do, but they know it's going to pay off long term. So while you credit the manager for pulling the right strings and making the right decisions, you got to credit the guys up front too.
Sure. There's no doubt. And, you know, I think about two guys in particular in that rotation, Carrasco and Bauer, who required a great deal of patience. All right. There were many times where nobody in this town would have batted an eye. In fact, would have applauded general manager Chris Antonetti, or at the time Mark Shapiro, for cutting loose Carlos Carrasco. Okay, even though he had the incredible arm talent, he just didn't seem to have the mental game to go with it. The comportment on the mound, he was, you know, doing various beanball type things and getting suspended, and just wasn't fulfilling his promise. So there were plenty of times where this front office had an opportunity to shed Carrasco and wouldn't have been criticized for it. And Bauer, you know, the same kind, not the same kind of deal in terms of craziness on the field, but it just didn't seem to be clicking for him. He incredibly bright, but maybe overthinking and not listening to some of the coaching in Cleveland. So this offseason in particular, is Bauer going to be moved? Is Bauer going to be moved? And I was one of those who said I wouldn't move Bauer because, number one, you'd be selling low, which you don't want to do. And number two, you put so much work in with Bauer to this point. Why not try, just hold on a little longer to see if you can, you know, get something consistent out of him. And the Indians had, I'm sure, plenty of temptations to trade him or, you know, get rid of him. And they didn't. They held on to him. And even though he started this year in the bullpen, they still believed he was going to help them at some point. And sure enough, I mean, they didn't hope or anticipate that Cody Anderson would fall flat. But when the opportunity arose, Bauer stepped in. And, in fact, I think Bauer stepped in for Carrasco originally, injury.
Yeah, because he was on the DL, right.
Yeah. But, you know, then there wouldn't have been room if Anderson had been pitching great and Carrasco came back. Who knows what would have happened to Bauer. But the point is Bauer came back, and, again, with the assistance of Chris Jimenez, an in-season pickup by the Indians, a veteran backup catcher. Bauer and Jimenez have been an incredible battery. So
I got to jump in here because we're up against our clock. But to me, Trevor Bauer, all he's doing right now is what he should have been doing since day one. I did not agree with the decision to put Anderson in the starting rotation based on his spring, and to keep Bauer out of it based on his spring. Bauer didn't like it. He didn't shout and throw a tantrum. He did get a little short with the press. I'll just pitch when they tell me to pitch. But he was obviously disappointed. But rather than hang his head and sulk down in the pen, he kept working, and he was ready for his opportunity when it came. And now he has claimed a spot in this rotation, and that's phenomenal. Dennis Mandeloff, Cleveland Plain Dealer, Northeast Iowa Media Group. And again, pick up his book. Find it on Amazon. It's called From A to Z, From Andrews to Zastadil. Great stuff, Dennis. I appreciate your insight on the Indians. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, buddy. There you go. It's 4 o'clock. That means time for Top of the Hour Sports Center. Let's get there now. We're going to shift gears to the NBA and the Olympics. What do they have to do with one another? You'll find out coming up on the Extravaganza.
Hit well. Deep center. Rajay Davis makes the catch on the warning track.
Dropped it?
Or did he?
I think he dropped it.
I got an out call with Field and Colbert. He's calling him out. This is going to be a double play. And the game is over.
He caught that ball.
How do you like me now?
Lindor.
Liftoff. Way back in. Gone to Souvenir City. Francisco Lindor, his ninth home run on the year. And a pair of solo shots here in the first.
Wow.
Uh-oh. Francisco Lindor drives one deep and way out of here. His second home run of the afternoon.
There's a fly ball to left off the bat of Uribe. Well back down the line and gone.
Nice.
First pitch of the fifth inning. Juan Uribe. There's a fly ball to right off the bat of Naquin. Way back in right and gone.
Wow.
On a 1-0, Tyler Naquin hits his sixth home run. Back-to-back home runs for the Indians. Justin hit a long fourth inning. And the fifth inning started with back-to-back home runs in the first three pitches. Fly ball to left off the bat of Napoli, and goodbye. Man,
nice.
Line drive that just sizzled out of here.
Whoa.
There goes the runner, swinging a fly ball right field. This one's deep off the bat of Chisenhall, and over the top of a leaping Mike Aviles. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. It is the fourth home run of the inning for the Cleveland Indians against Justin Verlander.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
That's exactly what it is. Hour number two is underway right here on the Extravaganza. Now we want to open up the phone lines to you. We had Dennis Mandeloff last segment talking about the Tigers getting swept by the Indians and why and how it is that the Indians are pulling away with the American League Central, even though it is only June 24, and nobody is crowning a division champion yet. It is a bigger spread right now than a lot of people thought. Certainly than I would have thought with the Indians at the top. If there was going to be a bigger spread between first and second than five games, I would have assumed it would be the Royals probably pulling away, the defending champions, and then maybe the Tigers. I didn't think the Indians, despite their pitching, would have the offense to be doing this right now as part of a nine-game winning streak, and they could get bigger. That lead could get bigger as they take on the last-place Atlanta Falcons for three starting tonight. All right.
Braves.
Braves. Beg your pardon. Thank you so much, Jim Cushlin. All right. A little distracted here because I'm going to shift gears and get into the Olympics. Now, I am not the biggest Olympic fan, okay? And what I mean by that is, it's so funny because I don't know if it's the professionalization of the Olympics that have turned me into something less than a fan.
I know that's part of it for me because I've said for the better part of a decade now, if you can only catch one event, winter or summer games, make sure it's winter Olympic hockey.
Because of the amateurs.
Because of the pros. They're basically all glorified NHL All-Star games.
Well, I understood, but what I mean by that as far as the amateur, this is my point. It used to be, and there's such a strange dichotomy here, it used to be the best thing about the Olympics was the amateurism. That Team USA in 1980 in hockey, it was our amateurs who beat the Russian professionals.
Right.
Okay? that our basketball team in the Summer Olympics always made up of a bunch of college kids who had barely a month to play together, playing every other nation's professionals.
Which is why, if you look it up, they didn't romp to gold all the time like they do now.
I mean, that's what gave birth to the Dream Team.
And right.
This is the dichotomy I'm talking about. I used to be so in love with Olympic basketball when my favorite college players were coming together and doing this to the other teams, the other countries in the world's professional players. I mean, it was incredible. The only game we had lost for several decades was, of course, the very controversial one in, 1960? Was it 60 when we got hosed? They put extra time back on for the Russians and allowed the Russians to have another shot at it.
I got to look, because 60 feels too early.
Yeah, well, I don't remember exactly when it was, but it doesn't matter, because the point is the college kids playing the other team's pro, the other world's, the other nation's pros, keep messing that up too. It was what made it so cool is the fact that, you know, this
72.
Small, fresh, 72. So, yeah, what am I thinking? 72. So, you know, this little small, undersized, you know, kid from Indiana, you know, a Stevie Alford, you know, point guard of the USA Olympic team playing with, and I don't know, I don't want to mix all the eras up, but I think Alford was like on maybe the 84 team or something like that. Who else was stars in 84? Was Michael Jordan an Olympian? Maybe he was out of North Carolina. Maybe James Worthy from North Carolina. I can't remember them all, but, you know, all the teams, but I just remember, you know, when it came to our Olympic teams, seeing all of the All-American players we watched all the year, you know, all year long, and for 4 years at a time, obviously, back then, watching them go to the Olympics and play was an extraordinary thing for me. And this is a young guy growing up. You know, I was in my teens in the early 80s, and in the late 80s, too, for that matter. So it was a big deal to me, and I really loved that aspect of the Olympics. Then when we lost, it got really, really bitter. I got really, really bitter. How on earth are we sending the college kids? You know, the other teams are using their pros. How come we don't send our pros? You know, yeah, Team USA lost, but guess what? If we'd have sent the best players in the NBA, we'd kick their blah, blah, blahs. And I was like that. I was that bitter, angry American because we lost. And when the Dream Team happened in 1992, I was the biggest proponent. Now, there were some people, probably my age now, back then, when I was a young guy, in 92, I was, 20? I was 24 years old, I guess. And I was all about it. There's probably a lot of other people a little bit older at the time who didn't like the fact that we were giving in to the professionalization of the Olympics, and they wanted to have the college athletes continue on. But I wanted to see us kick the you-know-whats of the rest of the world using our best players. And when they brought Magic and Michael and Bird and Karl Malone and John Stockton and Ewing and all these guys together, I was like, oh, my God, look what they're doing. This is going to be amazing. And I know there's still some bitterness there, obviously, for Detroit fans over Isaiah Thomas's exclusion from that team. And there should be, by the way. I get it. But I was all about it. And what did we end up winning every game in that 1992 Olympics by? We won by like an average of 45 points a game or something.
It was something ridiculous, yeah.
It just affirmed and confirmed for all of us what we had said, and that is if we really send America's best against the rest of the world's best, we're still number one, USA, USA. But now that it's become that, I'm less enthused by the Olympics because, again, if we send our best, even with Dream Team 2, you know, later on, at a couple of world competitions, I think world championships, we lost a couple in a row. And I don't remember, we weren't sending the very best of our best. It was just a bunch of pro players, and they weren't necessarily the best pro players. I got less interested in it. And I'm telling a long story here that I probably don't need to tell to get to the point I'm trying to make in this segment. But I'm not as into the Olympics as I once was. Strangely enough, I was into it when they were doing it with all amateurism. And then I really got into it even more because we said, yeah, we're sending our best, and it became the professional Olympics. And now I find myself here in 2016 kind of wishing it was back to the amateur style again, I guess. Maybe it would just add some more intrigue to it. For example, when I look at the USA, Team USA basketball roster that was announced, you know, I don't have a ton of excitement over it. Why? Because these aren't our best anymore. These are just some of our best, but these aren't the best players in America anymore. Team USA announced the official roster for the 2016 Olympics, and they include Carmelo Anthony. Is he one of the very best players in the NBA? Yeah, I guess. Is he one of the three or four best forwards to make Team USA? No, he's not. He's a scorer, that's all. Harrison Barnes. Is he one of the best players in the NBA? Forget about it. Did you watch him in the NBA Finals? If you say yes, you're lying, because he was invisible. You couldn't have. Jimmy Butler, one of the best players in the NBA? Yeah, one of the 12 best to make the roster? No, probably not. I don't know. That's a tough one. Kush, would you put Butler in there? If you were ranking the top 12 players in the NBA right now to go to Team USA, Jimmy Butler's probably not one of the top 12.
Yeah, I'd lean against that. I mean, because as, you know, there's other players that would be in that top 12 that are
playing. About it. DeMarcus Cousins is on this list. He's certainly one of the best centers, and depending on how much, you know, probably the best center in terms of talent. But he is also not necessarily the kind of guy you want to root for as an Olympian, because he is a coach-killing, egomaniacal, self-centered bore that I wouldn't want on my team if it was my team, let alone my Olympic team. But he is one of the best players, okay. DeMar DeRozan, he's an all-star. Does he belong on Team USA? Probably not. Kevin Durant, absolutely. He's a top three player in the world. Paul George, I'm okay with that, too. He probably belongs there no matter what. Draymond Green, sorry. Great player for his team and his role with the Warriors. One of the 12 best players in the world? No, forget it. Kyrie Irving, does he belong on this team? Absolutely. I'm fine with that. DeAndre Jordan, yeah, he was first-team All-NBA this year, but I question it. Kyle Lowry, forget about it. Klay Thompson, I'm okay with that too. My point is it's a very nice list of some of the better players in the league. It is not the list of the best players in the league, which of course is because LeBron opted out. He's not going to play because he needs rest. Curry is going to play because he got some injuries, and on down the line we go. So I'm a little less interested in the Olympics based on who we're sending. You know, is this team going to dominate all the others? I don't know, maybe, probably. Is it going to be very exciting for me or for you? Probably not. This Olympic story one, however, has grabbed my attention. It grabbed my attention last summer when we found out about it, that the water at the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil in August of 2016 is, let's just say, less than clean. The water, not just that people are going to be drinking, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about competitions. We're talking about rowing. We're talking about swimming. We're talking about triathlons. We're talking about diving. We're talking about open water competitions where athletes are going to go into water that is not healthy. And when I say not healthy, I don't mean isn't overflowing with vitamins. I mean it's filled with filth. I mean, the water levels, the levels of contamination of the water in Rio that these athletes are going to swim in is something that humans should not be ingesting. And that means breathing in, opening their mouths when they're swimming or and accidentally inhaling or getting any of it inside their system in any way, shape, or form. Heck, I don't even know, because I'm not a doctor. If somebody has a scab or some sort of other open wound being in this water, how much of that will give them an infection? That's how bad what we're talking about is. I bring it up because we brought it up about a year ago, and I read with great interest, and I listened with great interest to a number of people calling the IOC out and taking them to task for how can you expect these athletes to compete in these conditions. And I listened this morning to a reprisal of a stand that Mike Greenberg on ESPN's Mike and Mike in the Morning, hear it every day right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, a reprisal of a rant that he went on about 10 months ago, last August. Greenberg last August was so astounded as he read the stats about the amount of human waste that has been found to be in the water facilities that these athletes will train in and then actually compete in. We are talking about human waste. Yes, that human waste. Both kinds, both substances, if you will. At astronomical levels, as if they don't have water and sewage treatment plants there that you can rely upon. I don't know the reason why. I don't really care. What I do know is that the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, chose as its host city when they made this decision up 4 years ago. They chose as the host city a city that can't possibly host the world's athletes because it can't possibly expect the world's athletes to compete in third world conditions. Now, that's not a classist statement. I'm not sitting here saying, you know, with all kinds of xenophobia, we're number one, ethnocentricity, you know, it's, everything in the USA is better than everywhere else. I'm not doing that. I'm just saying we did have another city in play among the final four before they chose Rio, and it was Chicago. And I know there are a lot of things you could say bad about Chicago, too, particularly the number of shootings that happen in that city every weekend. It's a shooting gallery there, gangs and all kinds of other problems. But that is the kind of stuff with strong police and security that you can, of course, minimize, if not eliminate, during the time of the Olympics. That's different than infrastructure. Cities need to have infrastructure before they can bid to bring the entire world into their city walls, if you will, and ask the world and the world's athletes to compete without making themselves sick. Now, there's two things at play here. One is the Zika virus. That is something that is, of course, a very, very serious problem to the in terms of world health. It's not just in South America. It is throughout Africa, obviously as well. And there are some athletes who are so worried about contracting the Zika virus that they're not going to the Olympics. These athletes are people like Rory McIlroy, a golfer who's a pro golfer and one of the best in the world, who has millions of dollars for being great at golf professionally. He can afford to say, man, I'm not going to that one. I've got plenty of other things to play for besides an Olympic gold medal for my country. I've got all kinds majors. I got a bunch of tour majors to play in. I'm not going down there and risking my health and my life and potentially my own fertility as, you know, the problem with Zika virus leading to birth defects, et cetera, depending on which parent contracts the disease, I suppose. But for other athletes, like amateur athletes who don't make millions of dollars on a professional tour in their sport, this is the pinnacle. This is the glory moment for them. This is the opportunity to reach the highest point they can ever reach in their sport and thus possibly earn for themselves what could be a living, an entire career based on Olympic heroism and then endorsements, celebrity status, lifetime memories, not just for the athletes, but for the fans who cheer for those athletes. We all know who our Olympic heroes are. We know, we remember all of the gold medal winners, the greatest gold medal winners in Olympic history. And we know how many of them, whether they be gymnasts like Mary Lou Retton, or decathletes like Bruce Jenner, or track stars like Carl Lewis, or hockey stars like Jim Craig in 1980, or boxers like Sugar Ray Leonard and Muhammad Ali, and all those who, you know, won Olympic glory, they also won fame and fortune for a lifetime. So for these young people, they can't just skip the Olympics. They've got to go and participate in extraordinarily unsanitary and unsafe conditions if they want to have their moment of glory and try to build that career for themselves, is essentially what it comes down to. The water conditions in Rio are so unsanitary. Mike Greenberg this morning, as I say, reprised his rant of 10 months ago against the IOC, the executive committee, and officials in Rio for forcing these athletes to compete in such horrible conditions. He said he was so bad he calls it swimming in literally a toilet. I want to play this 2 minutes and 11 second clip for you from this morning's Mike and Mike in the Morning. Obviously, we don't want you to miss it live every day right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, as we are proud to be part of ESPN Sports Radio. But I want to play this for you now from this morning, Mike Greenberg, and I want to get your thoughts on it when we're done.
I have no way of connecting myself to this situation, right? I don't know how to put myself in this place. The closest I can come to imagining it is if one of my kids were an Olympic caliber athlete and they were facing something like this. I have a daughter who is 16. She's not all that far away. She's almost 16. Not all that far away from being at an age where, you know, you might want to have kids and all that sort of thing. So that brings the Zika side of this into consideration. And then the condition of the water. I mean, they're two totally different things, right? The Zika thing, no one can blame on the International Olympic Committee. It is not their fault that this epidemic or whatever it is specifically known as has been created and that this is near or in the epicenter of it. So no one can blame them for that, and I don't know what the solution to that is. The condition of the water is an absolute disgrace. It is It is bordering on a criminal disgrace. And I have said before, and I will repeat it again, we haven't gotten into this a lot lately because we've been busy with other stuff, but now we're a month away. I've said it again. This is an open invitation from me to any member of the International Olympic Committee's Executive Committee, which means basically the board of the Olympics. Any member of them, if you will allow me to videotape it, I will pay all expenses for you and your family to go swim in that water for an hour. Whatever it costs. I don't care what part of the world you're coming from. I don't care what the costs are. I will pay out of my pocket. This is not ESPN. I will pay out of my pocket the expenses for you and your family to go swim in that water for an hour if we can videotape it. There's not one of them that would take me up on that, because there's not one of them that would put themselves in that position. And the fact that they are forcing these kids, that they are forcing Megan O'Leary to choose between abandoning a dream that she has worked her entire life for, or going to perform in that toilet, which is literally what it is an outrage, and something should have been done about it. It is probably now too late for anything to be done about it, but something should have been done about this, and it is a disgrace.
It should have been, something should have been done about this. He's right, by the way. And by the way, you know, if you listen to the extravaganza with any regularity, you know that oftentimes I'll take Mike or Mike to task for certain things they say that I completely disagree with, or any other ESPN personalities, whether it's Stephen A. Smith or Russillo or Cannell or Blebetard or any of them. I'll take them, not that they care that I take them to task. They're doing their thing on the national level. We're here in Toledo, Ohio. But, I mean, you know, this is our forum to talk a little bit with one another about all these things that matter nationally in the world of sports, and I'll take them to task, and I'll also praise them when they deserve praise, and I'm so happy and proud of Mike Greenberg, because I view it through the same lens he does, and that is the lens of a father. If my young Olympic athlete, child, you know, somebody who is, 16, 17, 18, 19 years old, on their way to a dream, you only get one opportunity. You qualified for the Olympics by winning your own country's Olympic trials. You have an opportunity at the glory and, yes, the fame and fortune. Emphasis on fortune, too. This is a huge amount of money to be made here. Money that is earned through years of sweat and toil and blood sacrifices, you know, to your sport for training. If you pass the muster in your own Olympic trials in your country, the odds are very, very good it's only going to happen once. I mean, very rare is the athlete, a Michael Phelps, who can compete in two straight Olympics or any others. I mean, you know, and Mary Lou Retton or any of the gymnasts that you know from Olympic glory in years past, they only do it for one Olympic year. They don't get to do it again 4 years later. Very, very rarely do you see. You know, unless it's somebody like Carl Lewis, who is lightning fast at 20 and then gets an opportunity to do it again at 24 and maybe even 28 in rare cases. But most of the time, the younger crowd coming up pushes you out. You don't qualify again. So this is probably a once-in-a-lifetime thing. If my child had an opportunity to go and achieve this, and then I found out that what they were going to do is have to compete in conditions that could make them sick, possibly even, I don't want to say life-threateningly sick, but very seriously ill. The idea of them swimming and or diving and or rowing and splashing about in human waste? What do you do? I would be beside myself with rage. At the U.S. Olympic team for allowing this? The U.S. Olympic Committee, that is? And, of course, the larger picture, IOC, the International Olympic Committee, for allowing this? How do you choose a city that hasn't proven to you that they can host an Olympics without something that is going to make an enormous number of athletes sick? How do they greenlight Rio de Janeiro without proving that they even have the infrastructure to host such an event? Untreated human waste has long fouled Rio de Janeiro's beaches and docks. And the picturesque lagoon, you've probably seen all of these kinds of photos, postcard-like photos of Rio de Janeiro. What a wonderful place to visit. What a great place for a vacation. What a tremendous destination point. Yeah, except for the human waste, fecal and urine waste floating around in their waters. And now these athletes are supposed to swim and or row and or participate in it. I can't even imagine. Now, you heard a name mentioned there by Mike Greenberg. He said Megan O'Leary. She's an Olympic rower. She used to work for ESPN, which gives them obviously some access to her and a little bit of the story there. But Megan O'Leary is a rower. She qualified for this team. She has one shot, just like I said, as most of these athletes will. One time in her life will she get to go to the Olympics. Whereas some athletes, as I pointed out before, are just skipping it because they don't want to get sick and they don't want to swim in a literal toilet. Others don't have a choice because they're never going to be able to come back, and this is their only shot at it. Well, they asked her this morning. Mike Greenberg was in, obviously, on Mike and Mike, and Mike Golick was out. So Ryan Russillo and Danny Cannell were in. So it's Greenberg, Russillo, and Cannell doing the interview with Megan O'Leary this morning. And they asked her how she is preparing for the conditions that she is going to have to face when she is there, talking about the actual quality of the water. So I'm going to ask you to listen to another quick two-minute clip here. This is Mike and Mike with Megan O'Leary. And I want you to put yourself in this position, either as the athlete yourself or the parent of a young championship caliber Olympic quality athlete, how you would handle it, what you would advise your young child to do if they had to go and participate in these kinds of conditions. But this is just two more minutes with Mike and Mike and Megan O'Leary.
What do people tell you from the U.S. side about what you should prepare yourself for? Like, how do they talk to you about things to avoid and getting you ready for what could be a challenge there?
Right. So, I mean, and that's the USOC, that's our NGB, U.S. Rowing, that is sort of, you know, trying to manage some of the circumstances and things we're going to have to deal with when in Rio. And it's, I mean, it's kind of the common sense things. Unfortunately, there's no magic potion or special formula. It's, you know, we're going to have to immediately upon coming off the water, wash our hands, try not to get water in our mouth. And, I mean, where I sit in the boat, I am constantly splashed. It's in my ears, it's in my eyes, it's in my mouth. So it's a, you know, it's a real thing that I'm kind of like, wow, what can I do to protect myself? Do I wear goggles? Do I wear extra coverage? And I mean, the answer to that is yes, you have to cover yourself more. You have to be really careful about, you know, when we're drinking our water in the boat, making sure nothing comes into contact with it. So it's all the common sense stuff that you would sort of think of. And like I said, unfortunately, there's no magic remedy. It's just going to have to be a little bit of luck, a little bit of extra, you know, diligent care, and that's really it. Unfortunately, that's all we can kind of use to protect ourselves.
You know, it's I'm just jumping in here for a quick second. I'll get back to the last 40 seconds of this clip. You heard what she said. Sitting in her position on the boat, she's constantly getting splashed with water from the rowing in her face, in her ears, in her eyes, and you heard her, in her mouth. What do I do? Do I wear goggles? Yeah, great. Can you wear some sort of a waterproof earmuff? Yeah, probably. Great. But you have to breathe. You have to breathe. That filth, that human waste, that toilet water, literally used toilet water, is going to end up in her mouth. And as you breathe and gasp, and it's going to end up in her body because she's going to swallow it, as are all of the others. It's just the nature of water sports. It's the way it happens. For this to be the case, is unconscionable. Unconscionable. Here's the rest.
Do you feel that your federation and that the USOC have done everything that can be done to prepare you for this in every way?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you know, the water quality has been something that's been in the news for, God, over a year now, right? And so that was something that was on sort of everyone's minds long before Zika. So there were preparations being made, and sort of, you know, there was a test event last summer that we were eyeing. It was a rowing event that we were watching and making, you know, seeing what happened to those athletes competing. Unfortunately, several athletes did get sick for whatever reason, whether it was the water or something outside that was more, you know, maybe a restaurant or, you know, something environmental outside of the water. And so we've been, you know, they've been communicating with us. They've been coming up with, you know, these are the strategies that we think will help you. But like I said, there's no magic potion. So it's a little bit like, yeah, I kind of know that that's what I need to do. But, you know, I wish there was something a little bit more that we would be able to be equipped with. But I mean, the truth is, I'm not sure there really is.
There isn't. That's it. Essentially, what she's saying is what's true, that there is no remedy. There is no magic potion. There is no way to stop it. You're going to either drink the toilet water, literally swallow it as it splashes into your face. You're going to swallow other people's waste, or you're not going to compete. That's the bottom line here. That's what she has been tasked with, and the rest of them as well. My question to you, And I really want you to ask you, if you were an athlete, would you go and put yourself through that, knowing it's your one shot at the Olympics? Or if you're the parent of an athlete, a young, you know, 18, 19-year-old Olympic quality or caliber athlete who made the team and is ready to go, are you ready to go? Yes, sir. Are you going to win a gold medal for your country? Yes, we are. Are you ready to swim in a toilet? What? Yeah, you're going to have to swim in and potentially ingest other people's physical waste, uretory and excretory. Are you ready? No. What would you do if it was your child? What would you do if it was you? 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. I want your answer to those questions right on the other side of this timeout, which is coming your way, as I also offer you a couple of nice prizes. Remember I told you about the Marathon Classic? You know full well we'll be broadcasting there on the Thursday and Friday of the Classic. I've got a four-pack of tickets. Four-pack of tickets to the Marathon Classic. In fact, I've got a couple four-packs of tickets. I'll give them away to the 10th and 11th callers right now at 866-240-1065. The Marathon Classic at Highland Meadows in Sylvania coming July 11th through the 17th. We'll be there again Thursday and Friday that week, first two rounds of the tournament. We would love for you to be there with us. Four packs of tickets to the 10th and 11th callers. 866-240-1065. Right back after this.
Part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 1065 The Ticket.
Indeed. Don't forget to check out the website all the time at 1065theticket.com. And congratulations to Jeremy Carter of Perrysburg and to Bob Joyce of Oregon. Both were our 10th and 11th callers, respectively, and they're going to the Marathon Classic. I've got many, many more tickets for the Classic coming up over the course of this week and next, and we'll also give away a couple of other different prizes today before we're done here at 5 o'clock, about, 14 minutes from right now. All right, I want to go to Jeremy in is this our winner? Is this Jeremy in Perrysburg who also wants to comment? All right, it is. Same winner. How about that? Congratulations to Jeremy, and also we'll chat a little bit now about the Olympics as well. Jeremy, thanks for the time. How are you, Jeremy?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you for the tickets. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Enjoy the tournament. It should be an awful lot of fun.
Yes.
What do you think? Would you send your child, what advice would you give somebody, especially if it was somebody you cared about having to go and compete in such horrific conditions?
I honestly was calling to kind of check ourselves a little bit on the way that I was wondering, has anybody released like a parts per billion number or any kind of like statistical information other than just people saying it? Because a lot of our tributaries in source water have the same kind of E. coli or total coliform bacteria in them.
It's not even close. It's not even close. And I don't have them in front of me, but obviously the people who are talking about this aren't just saying, I heard there's poop in the water. They have all of that data. As a matter of fact, they had to have multiple experts such as the doing something called a QMRI, quantitative microbial risk assessment, et cetera,
yep,
where they do
yep.
have all of the parts per million and all this other nonsense. And quite frankly, and I didn't really understand this until this Olympic situation, but they're saying this isn't new, that Rio has long been known for human waste polluting the beaches and all of the resort areas that people flock to Rio for. It's just something that they deal with there. It has long been a problem. They just don't have the proper sewage treatment systems there in place that a lot of other, you know, advanced nations have.
Well, then I'm going to have to go ahead and say that at sports, I love them to death and always wish that I could go and be part of them all, but none of them are worth any kind of risk to my health or life or my family.
Yeah, I would think so too. And it's not, you know, it's not an easy decision. Like you heard, you know, this Megan O'Leary that Mike and Mike did the interview with this morning. She's a rower and she's been working her life, like Mike said, to get an opportunity to go to become an Olympic champion, and to give that up simply because they couldn't give you a safe place to compete. I don't know. I feel like there's got to be some recourse for these athletes if they end up not going out of fear for their own health and safety.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, obviously, we know through just past history with IOCs and the corruption and the way things can go that none of it seems clean. So you always have to ask the questions, and that's the unfortunate part of our society is these questions have to be asked, and we just can't take everybody for granted that they know what they're doing.
Well, not only can you not take for granted that they know what they're doing, you have to just trust that you aren't in the middle of one of the corrupt situations where they know full well what they're doing, and it's the wrong thing. And you know, I was also listening to another part of the show this morning and on Mike and Mike, and they were talking to Jerry Colangelo. They're talking about Team USA, and I was running on the basketball roster last half hour. And they, you know, and some of the athletes might not want to go because of this. And they were talking to Jerry Colangelo about it. And Colangelo, who was on the USOC, meaning he was part of the team that went to bid on the Olympics for 2016 in Copenhagen a few years ago. And Chicago was one of the finalists, four finalists. It was Rio and Chicago. And I don't remember the other two. It's irrelevant. But he found out at the time and then shortly thereafter that it was a waste of time. Rio had been chosen. They gave Rio the bid long before the other organizations, including the USOC, even got a chance to give their presentation for Chicago, that the whole thing was rigged with backdoor deals and greased palms, et cetera, et cetera. So it doesn't matter how filthy Rio is, doesn't matter how violent and how bad the crime rate is there, and it is bad, how many drugs flow through there, and there are a lot, or how much human waste is in the water for the athletes. Rio is getting this because of corruption at the IOC, and that's essentially what Jerry Colangelo confirmed this morning.
And my last statement would be is imagine the money that they spent greasing those palms and what it could have done to their infrastructure and the ability to help their people, minus the Olympics itself.
What a great point. And do they not even realize how bad this has got? I mean, I don't know about you. I don't have the money to travel the world. I'm just not that guy. I did, my wife and I would love to go to Europe. We'd love to maybe go to – she's even mentioned it would be beautiful to see Rio. You know, even there even to go there just to see the glorious Jesus statue, which is important to a lot of people, you know. It's a destination point for so many millions of people around the world. What do you think this knowledge, now that this Olympic scandal is here and the corruption that gave them the Olympics is here, and the world is finding out what had been maybe only only known to the locals, because I didn't know about this, that if you go to Rio, if you have any intentions of vacationing in the water, you're going to be vacationing essentially in toilets, in human filth. So this is something that could cost them millions, if not billions of dollars going forward in negative publicity that might turn people to another destination if they're looking for a place for vacations.
Oh, without a doubt. I wish there was some way to boycott. I mean, the only way we speak our vote, if they get to go through with it and they make the money, then there's never anything that's going to stop them from doing it again.
Exactly right. That's well said. Hey, Jeremy, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Really, really good.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you got it.
Have a good day.
Yep, enjoy the classic again. This is really, I mean, I'm going to read just a couple of quick lines here. The USOC does not have any authority to order its water athletes to withdraw because of the conditions. Instead, they're focusing on providing information, along with beefed up medical counsel, according to the CEO of the committee, Scott Blackman. Scott Blackman says, quote, "The water in Rio is dirty. We need to do everything we can to prevent our athletes from getting sick while they're down there. But our athletes have competed in difficult conditions around the globe on many occasions in the past, and it's just a matter of making sure our precautions are specifically targeted to the conditions we're going to find in Rio." Now, you hear that. This is a guy, I mean, obviously, who doesn't want to try to tell his athletes not to go and compete. They can't order them anyway, but they have to advise them of the conditions. And then saying, but you know what? People have competed in tough conditions before. Well, not like this. As Megan O'Leary explained, "I am going to get splashed in the water repeatedly every time we row. I'm going to get splashed in the face with the poop water and the pee water. And it's going to go in my eyes, and it's going to go in my ears, and it's going to go in my mouth. And if I'm breathing incorrectly at the time, it's going to go into my lungs, and it could very certainly go into my stomach. Because when you get splashed in the face and you're breathing and you're doing your work, you know, you're going to ingest stuff. It just happens in the water. There is nothing she can put over her mouth and still allow her to breathe that is not going to let water through. She can wear goggles. She can cover her ears. She can cover almost all of her body so that the poop water doesn't go into her, you know, onto most of her body. But she has to breathe. And unless they allow them to compete with oxygen tanks on their back the way scuba divers use so they can breathe out of that, and I don't think that is something they'd want to do anyway, then there's no way to stop this for them. The water is more than just dirty. It is filthy. It is waste. And I don't know anybody who's going to want to go diving headfirst into the contents of a porta potty, even if there is a gold medal at the bottom of it. Let's go one more to Kevin in Maumee. Kevin, thanks for joining us. You're on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Would you go, Kevin?
Yeah, I think I would. I think I just think we maybe blow this a little out of proportion. I think people vacation there all the time. I just think that we have, you know, when we get into this corruption, there's always been corruption surrounded around the Olympics. I feel like Chicago, and we have spent a bunch of money to bring it to Chicago. There's all sorts of problems where money could have been spent better in Chicago than building Olympic facilities. I think we let the Olympics play out and we enjoy the games. This pretty much happens all the time around the Olympics, and I think they'll be great games.
Well, I think everything you said is fine with the exception of that second to last line where you said this is the kind of thing that happens all the time around the Olympics. Corruption happens all the time, yes. But this kind of filthy, inexcusable, unimaginable of a waste problem, of a pollution problem where the athletes can get very, very sick because of this. I don't know that this has ever happened before. Corruption has happened, but this is more than corruption. This is just a lack of basic human cleanliness infrastructure for the games. And I think that's why this is getting so much attention. I don't think it's people are trying to blow it out of proportion. They're just maybe putting themselves in the swimmer's shoes or in their wetsuits, if you will, because they're trying to imagine what they would do if they were in it.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. I do think that our Olympic committees, though, and I think they do know well about this, and they're going to come prepared, and I think it will be a lot quieter than we're all playing it up to be right now.
Yeah,
I hope I'm right.
I really hope the athlete. Thanks so much for the call. I appreciate your opinion on it, Kevin. Good stuff. I really hope this is something we're not talking about much later, because that will mean that the athletes were able to protect themselves or didn't get as sick as maybe they feared they might. But I just can't imagine wanting to go through with this under those unknowns. I'm looking at a story from May, so it's a little over a month ago. It's May 19th. Rio's filthy water is already making pro athletes sick. Now, mind you, this is 3 months before the games. Just ask surfers, because the surfers at the in the areas where the Olympics are going to be held have been surfing for a long time, not just talking about Olympics, but just locals. And they are acknowledging what everybody is saying. Local biologist Mario Moscatelli blames the latest stink fest on a couple of huge swells that battered Rio last month, sending waves into the city's inland lagoons where they churned up in the seabed and released noxious gases and filth, including layers upon layers of human waste from underwater. "Excuse my frankness," he wrote in an email, "but the rivers feeding into the lagoons are pure S." It's a four-letter word. It starts with S and it ends in T. And in the middle is hi. All right? That's what they're talking about. He said the feces of thousands of people have emptied into the river without treatment. And this is what they're surfing in. And this is what the athletes are going to compete in. I'm sorry. I couldn't do it. I wish I had more time to talk, but I don't. Mike Miller's waiting in the wings. Hey, before I go, how about I hook you up with another prize like I said he would? On the way out the door, call 866-240-1065 if you're interested in the LaGrange Street Polish Festival, July 8th to the 10th. I got a four-pack of tickets for you if you are the 10th caller. I got another four-pack of tickets for you if you are the 11th caller. You want to go to the Polish Festival, be the 10th or 11th caller at 866-240-1065. So enjoy that on the way out the door. Thanks for being a part of the show today. We're back tomorrow at 3 o'clock to do this all over again, better than we did it today. Mike Miller and Drive Time are next right here on The Ticket. We'll see you.